Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as professor of law at NYU and senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, breakdown in Europe. And Richard, as we tape this episode, we've had a series of stories about political and cultural unrest coming out of Europe. First among them really being the situation in the UK, where Theresa May, the prime minister, is in the unenviable position of having to navigate Britain's exit from the European Union. That has thus far gone smoothly. Not clear that she's going to be able to get it out of Parliament. Not clear that she can wring any concessions out of the EU that would make it more likely to get out of Parliament. She just survived a no confidence vote earlier this week. But it is unclear at this point how you translate British voters' will about leaving the EU into a workable policy. And you've got no small number of folks in the UK saying that maybe they should just take another vote. So, Richard, let's start from the beginning here. Was it a mistake for the UK to go down this road in the first place? And now, from where we are today, is there a viable way out?
When the original deal came forward, I took the basic view that a cautious vote for Brexit. And the theory was that if they could extricate themselves through sensible negotiations, the removal of the heavy burdens of the bureaucrats sitting in Brussels, the greater opportunity for free trade with other nations would more than offset the dislocations that took place. But this was a cautious vote for Brexit. And I had no idea that Mrs. May would be so clueless in the way in which she actually conducted the operation. The difficulties began long before the current impasse. Shortly after, when she was riding high, what she did is she decided to call for a snap election. And in the midst of that election, she did what most conservatives do when they want to lose. She played Mitt Romney as of 2012, announcing that she could outperform the Labour Party when it came to empathy and to the protection of welfare rights. That's a fool's errand. You can't win that battle. You're playing in somebody else's strong suit. What you have to do is to attack the notion that these kinds of benefits will be sustainable and constantly put your heft behind the principle of growth through deregulation and market economy. That's what basically got Britain out of Brexit. I think it was not so much a nativism on the one hand. Most of the people who were pro-Brexit were free traders. And what she did is she basically campaigned on the wrong slogan, and that gave Labour a huge leg up. Its leader is Jeremy Corbyn. He is a real statist. He's probably an anti-Semite. He certainly is, I think, in many ways, perhaps the most dangerous leader ever to get close to a position in post-war Europe. And what happens is one of the reasons why Mrs. May manages to keep this frail boat of competence is that the thing gets toppled and there's another election, it could well be that the Labour Party will win on the very simple maxim, throw the rascals out. So she did not do anything that was right with respect to this in terms of the internal campaign that weakened her in these negotiations. Also, I think she is a Brexiter without conviction. She was described to me as somebody who ought to be running the Home Office, which she did run, because she's good at rounding up suspects and dealing with problems having to do with short-term crises. But as far as I can tell, she has no long-term vision of how things ought to work. Then to make it worse, what she has to do is to confront Angela Merkel. And Ms. Merkel, I think, started strong and then got much weaker as her term of office went on. She clearly misplayed the refugee question, being much too willing to have open borders on that question. Ostensibly, that's an issue which starts and ends in Germany, and it's not technically an EU issue. But the spillovers on that and also on the internal migration of people throughout the European Union is one of the really important issues that you have to face. And what happened is she became weakened. And when she became weakened, what she decided to do was to be more aggressive with respect to the British. Her attitude is that they fall out, other people will leave, and German hegemony will be compromised on all fronts as people cease to have the EU as an EU and turn it into much more of a trading bloc. So that's two down. The third piece of this, of course, is Mr. Macron. And as best I can tell, the guy believes in pro-growth economy, but on the other hand, he's French to the core, and therefore believes in growth economy through more regulation of the signs that he wants, like his recent proposals to raise the minimum wage. And then he bet his all on climate change and higher taxes, which was a colossal blunder. So what you do now in Europe is you have three enfeebled leaders, none of whom have a clear pro-growth situation. And since they all want various forms of state control, it's not at all clear whom the voters should prefer. And as best I can tell, it's a situation in which there's no exit. And I think other people have said, now, if they only had Donald Trump's pro-growth policies without all of his personal baggage, they might have done a lot better collectively than they're doing today. Because the more you deregulate in the EU, the more credible it is for the Brexiters to say, oh, we can stay in after all.
Richard, the narrative that has taken hold as regards Europe has been roughly as follows. The political elites rush headlong into globalization, both in terms of economics and in terms of migration, which you mentioned. And they do so in a way that never fully accounted for the dislocations that would happen to the non-elite. So this is applicable in this telling to all the countries that we've just discussed. The British sort of resenting the heavy hand of the EU. The French, we've had demonstrations and riots sort of bristling at Macron's economic reforms. The Germans pushing back on Merkel's immigration policy. And the fear is here that because these leaders didn't trim their sails a little bit more on the globalization agenda, that you're going to wind up with something much worse, with a really aggressive populist backlash. Obviously, a lot of people would make that case about what's happened in the U.S. as well. To what extent do you buy that narrative, and what are the prospects for these countries to navigate those tensions?
My own sense about the way in which this particular narrative works is that the moment there's instability, it always gives the leading edge to any extremist group in any country. And since there's no clear vision towards prosperity that is being put forward by the leadership, everybody on the outside looks at the insiders as a bunch of privileged people who are willing to indulge themselves. So in France, I think the general response to the fuel taxes, what are you worried about global warming when I can't get to work every day? This is not based upon the science of the issue, which would say, I think, in my view, that these are futile gestures which will make only trivial changes in carbon dioxide, assuming that the changes in carbon dioxide would have any negative effect with respect to global warming. So they see themselves being put down on an altar, and they don't know where to turn. So what they do is they take to the streets because they don't think there are any political parties who support them. That has not quite happened in England or in Germany. Both of them, I think, are a little bit more prosperous because they don't have quite the heavy level of taxes. And both of them, at least domestically, have modest liberalization problems, which make the situation start to work. But the longer this particular confrontation goes on, the more likely it is that somebody's going to blow a gut. Ms. Merkel has already announced that she's going to step aside, and her chosen successor has very weak support. Ms. May has very weak support. Macron has very weak support. So you have three weak leaders in search of a theme on which they could do, and absolutely, as far as I can see, no real clue on what ought to happen. I'm going to say it again, because I think it's the only situation that works, is that market liberalization in all of these places is the only way in which you can move these things forward. It increases the size of the pie, and the moment you start reducing the heavy hand of the Brussels Commission on everybody else, there's less of a reason for somebody to want to leave Brexit, more reason for them to start to say. If it turns out Ms. Merkel says, look, I'm willing to do a deal, and what we do is we keep the movement of capital and the movement of services back and forth across these lines and the movement of capital, but I'm willing to slow down on the movement of people with the idea of resettling in other countries, that would make, I think, people much easier on the resettlement issue, but she doesn't want to do this. Now, what makes this even worse is if you actually look elsewhere inside the EU, there's strong economies which have two characteristics. One, they're relatively free market. I'm talking about Hungary and Poland. And they're also relatively authoritarian. And that also is an extremely toxic mix. And so one of the things that one's worried about is if it turns out that the three leaders inside the current EU configuration all are in very bad shape, it means that there's going to be all sorts of demands from people on the periphery to try to renegotiate their deal in one form or another. So I can see this spreading pretty much throughout all of Europe, and I think that the beneficiaries of this are going to be the enemies of Europe. That would include the Russians and probably the Iranians as well. It's a very sorry pickle. I had no idea 2 years ago that it would come to this. If I had thought that everybody would have been as collectively inept as they have turned out to be. I would have said it was not worth at that particular time upsetting the status quo. You'll live with Brexit and try to work from within. Is that a good alternative? No, it's not a good alternative, because when the British tried that before the removal, they were met a sense with the resistance that we like the four freedoms that we have together, and we're also in the kind of position where we're not in favor of any form of basic transformation. The root difficulty in this, I think, took place many years ago when they decided at the Treaty of Maastricht that what was going to happen is they were going to convert something which was basically a free trade zone into something that looked like more like a centralized confederation with direct powers of regulation. And that is, I think, the huge mistake. The creation of the euro puts additional financial pressures on this. So you have to go back perhaps 20 years in order to see how it was that this particular stew gave rise. And it's the same thing. Overambition is very, very dangerous in politics. Maintaining low tariffs and free movement of goods and services across line is relatively easy. Allowing countries to adjust their currencies one to another makes a lot of sense if it turns out that you don't have any real strong centralized control over budgets. The EU has tried to create that, but the national governments are too strong and they always manage to resist it. So back of all the Brexit uncertainty and all the current conflagrations are the whole problem with respect to the instability in the lending markets, the currency crisis with Greece and Portugal, Italy and Spain and so forth. So these guys have done a complete and total mess in the way in which they've handled the situation. And, you know, I think liberalization is the only thing that will work, as I've said, but I think the prospects are very dim because I believe all of the elites in all of these countries in their own way don't believe in that. I think all of them think that they are smarter than the other guy and therefore they could kind of run things one way or the other. I don't believe anybody is that particularly smart, which is why decentralization turns out to be the dominant economic strategy. But the best options are all off the table, and I think it's going to be a period of very powerful short-term disruption, and I wouldn't even begin to guess what the final solution is going to be in any of these countries. Let's put it in the simplest terms. You've got three major countries in Europe. Each of them has a crisis of confidence with respect to its government. These things are not independent. They're synergistic.
Given all those potential liabilities and the geopolitical consequences that you referenced a few moments ago, is there a productive role for the United States to play here?
Well, I mean, there's a productive role for the United States to play if they had a productive leader. But, I mean, trying to have Donald Trump intervene in this situation when he's generated so much ill will overseas, I think is an extremely difficult thing to do. The only way I think that the United States can succeed is if it turns out that the president takes a back seat on all of these situations, tries to take somebody like Pompeo, the Secretary of State, or some other leading economic figure and have them see if they can negotiate various kinds of free trade deals of one sort or another with these kinds of countries. But it's not at all clear what we can do. We're an outsider. If you recall when Barack Obama announced that we're going to put Britain at the back of the line if they decide to leave Brexit, that was regarded, rightly in my view, as a kind of an interference in foreign affairs. And there are many people who believe that the slender majority that the Brexiters obtained was in fact a reaction to what the United States through Obama had done. And so I think it's really very much fraught with danger under these circumstances. My own advice would be is that you wait until somebody calls you, and if they ask you, you try to use your good offices to help these things. Which way it would take, nobody can possibly say at this particular point. The tension on these particular issues is nothing short, I think, of unbearable. I don't think there's much that we can do to keep things calm. I do think there are lots of things that the Russians or the Iranians can do in order to try to roil them up. And so my fear is that what looks to be a crisis of confidence in three nations inside the European Union could spread and have geopolitical and perhaps military implications that spread beyond it. It's very hard to think of any situation which is more dire than the one that these characters have managed to create by their independent and somewhat truculent actions.
So the last question that I'll ask you, you've got these three embattled leaders in Europe, Theresa May, Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel. If these three individuals are stocks and you've got to buy one, Richard, which one are you buying?
Oh, God. I mean, I think I would probably, notwithstanding all the stupidities, probably would buy Macron. And that's because I think that Ms. May suffers from terminal ineptitude on substantive issues. Macron at least has some sense of what it was he wants to do. And I think that he's probably learned from his mistake with respect to the carbon tax. And I hope he would return now to the task of market liberalization. I think he might do it some, but he's going to have to be very cagey about it because the populists are also, in many cases, very strong labor people. I don't think you could put many money on Miss Merkel because I think she's heading out the door. And I think she has so much difficulties inside that everybody's waiting for it to go. Her successor, when she comes in, might be somebody who's able to bridge the gap, but it's completely untested. So I would stick amongst the three with Macron, and I'm giving myself a B- over a couple of C-.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.